Welcome to the Bookshopier podcast. I'm John Purcell, and I'm joined by Sarah McJulie, and we're very excited to have Hanya Yanagihara to join us here to talk about A Little Life, which has been an enormous success. One of those books that has had people hug it, my sister for one, at the end of reading it, holding it to their chest and hugging the book. Hanya, how are you dealing with the success of A Little Life?
Well, thank you guys so much for having me on and for being such a huge supporter of this book. And this book has been, its success has been a huge shock for all of us, I think, both in the UK and in the US and, of course, in Australia, where it's been, I think, probably pound for pound the most successful. But it really was something that originated with booksellers It found its audience organically, which I think has been deeply satisfying for all of us. There wasn't a big marketing campaign behind it. It didn't have a big advance behind it. And it really was all about booksellers putting it in the hands of readers and then readers passing it on to other readers. So it's, I think, you know, I used to work in book publishing. I know how rare it is. And when it does happen and you're lucky enough to have it happen, it's frustrating because it's not replicable in a sense, but it's wonderful because it is the reason all of us are in books for one reason or another, whether we're sellers or editors or writers. So I think it's kind of a collectively happy moment for the industry.
Well, Sarah has just finished.
I'm so behind the times. It took me so long. It took me so long to start, but once I'd started, it was basically a couple of days worth of reading. And with a few little breaks, a few little pauses to gather my emotions and tattered shreds of myself back together so I could keep going. But yeah, I just feel such debilitating sadness still 2 days after reading the book. I don't even know what to say.
I tried to comfort Sarah yesterday. She described it as she was reading and she was babysitting at the time, so she had a couple of cherub kids looking across the room, so she could look up and look at the cherub faces and think.
Remind myself.
They're all wonderful, and I tapped her on the shoulder and said, "No, life is hell. Life is hell."
Well, so, that's very helpful. Yeah, I'm sure she really appreciated that kind of comfort.
But it's not just. I feel like having waited so long to read the book and heard so many people say it's so sad and it's so dark and there's violence. I think I had a really wrong idea of what it would be like, because as much as all those things are true, it wouldn't hurt so much if there wasn't such shining hope and if there wasn't such beauty, because it's also so romantic. And it's,
well, thank you. I mean, I'm glad it is a romance, and the book is ultimately a love story. It's a very old-fashioned book in a lot of ways, and it's one of the ways I think it's old-fashioned is it's very sincere. It's not about ironic distance. It's not about people who have an inability to feel or to express love for one another, and I think that makes it not quite a realistic book, but it is about a romance, as you say, Sarah, and there's two romances that really anchor it. The romance between Jude, the main character, and Willem, his best friend, and between Jude and his adoptive father, Harold. And one of the things I wanted to explore is this idea we have of friendship and how a friendship, even a friendship without sex, can be romantic in a way, in a much bigger sense of than how we consider romance. In our daily lives, we think of it as something to do with wooing, and something to do as a means to an end, and that end is a sexual relationship. But that's not always the case, and that's a fairly modern invention. And so, I wanted to write a romantic capital R and lowercase R book set in a contemporary setting.
You mentioned just before about it being realistic. A thing that struck me so much about the book is that while it is obviously a very realistic book grounded in reality, there's this dreamy quality to it this is going to be a roundabout way of asking you a question, but one of the characters in the book, JB, is an artist, and some of the most vivid descriptions are of his work, and that he paints from photographs that are sort of blurry.
Right.
And continually through the book, as I was reading those little snippets of their relationships in these like blurry paintings that jumped so vividly into my mind. I'm losing my voice, sorry. No. It's emotion. I won't lie, I'm remembering the book and I'm getting sad. is that so much of the book is blurred. Mm. So the characters that you've written are so clear, but all of the hallmarks that would normally identify them, like race, sexuality, family, are really blurry, and they're not, like, they're just not clear. And even the time, like, we know how old the characters are because you tell, like, they say how old they are.
Right.
But there's not that sense of time moving. There's a really dreamy quality to it that's just, I haven't really encountered it before, and
Well, thank you. Well, thank you so much. I mean, I did want it to feel, as you say, very dreamlike. And sometimes that dream turned into something more akin to a nightmare, but it also should feel unmooring for the reader. The reader, as you said, never quite knows what year he's in. He never quite knows what's happening in history. And then I hope after a certain point, those concerns become incidental to the experience of reading the book. You really are trapped within the universe of these four characters and their interior lives, and the rest of the world falls away, and it becomes it's about a personal history rather than something larger about New York or about contemporary society, which become abstractions. And that was one of the things I tried to play with. You know, I was talking yesterday at one of the events about how the book that actually helped me create this particular New York of A Little Life was The Golden Compass by Philip Pullman, and he creates an Oxford that's a recognizable Oxford, but not quite. It's an Oxford that's shifted on its axis. And so what it becomes is a sort of dream of Oxford rather than a literal interpretation of Oxford. I thought that was such a beautiful and interesting and provocative way of talking about a place that we think we know in the public imagination, but giving it a very personal and sort of refracted edge. And that's what I tried to do in this book. Not so much a magical realism, but a realistic magic.
Yeah.
In this age, one thing that I've noticed over the year and a bit since we all got the proof copies, is how it affects people. Like, being an artist and actually getting a response out of the reader or the viewer or whoever it happens to be, it's the hardest thing. It's the thing you aim for.
Yeah.
But you've got response. Like, you've got. I remember seeing a Facebook post of a person who, a writer that had read it and didn't like it, and then the people came into and it went on for, it was probably 400 different comments from a whole range of different readers, from other writers to booksellers to just the public, coming in, and all of them were passionate about it in many different ways.
Right.
Some didn't like it with great anger.
Right.
Some loved it with such they were willing to go to war for it.
Right.
You know?
That's like the experience of reading the book, though. Every emotion is heightened. Like, when you're scared, it's like you have to put the book down because the violence is so raw. When you're sad, you can't read because you're crying.
Well, I mean, I do think that, you know, I don't read responses about this book in anywhere. So I don't read reviews. I'm not on Twitter. I'm not on Facebook. So to a certain extent, I've been fairly insulated. Except when people take the time to tell me, which I always appreciate, because it is, as you said, John, ultimately what you want. The worst thing to have when is to create a book and people just shrug. Mm. And so you want the book to, when a book has generate such divisive responses, but passionate divisive responses, you know in a way that you've done something you wanted to do. You've done something that was not inert, and you've created something that had its own sort of life, and you've created something that people have taken seriously and engaged with in a serious way. And that is really all you can ask for, and in a sense, the ultimate compliment. And so beyond that, you can't do anything. You can't control how people react. You know, the emotions with which people have greeted this book have been a surprise to me, in fact, because they weren't my first reader was not very emotional about the book, nor was my editor, nor was my agent. And so they responded to it, but they were able to do so coolly, I guess. And so to have readers have such visceral reactions to the book, for good or for bad, has been unexpected, but across the board flattering for me.
What was it like to write it? That's what I wanted to ask.
It was great in a lot of ways, and it's great because I think anyone who works in a creative project knows that you want to feel that you are so invested in the life of that book that you can't get out of it. And that's a wonderful feeling, even if the subject matter is difficult, and even if you're asking your characters to withstand terrible things. So in that sense, it's it's hard, but it is also glorious. And one of the things I told my reader, who read every section of this book as I wrote it, was that I did want it to go into spaces that I would not be naturally inclined to go into as a writer. I wanted it to feel very, very big and very emotional and very excessive. And I needed him to tell me that it was okay to do that, because I knew it would be that sort of book. And so it was the hardest part, in a way, was writing against my own instincts to be more withholding.
I was wondering, in that process, in writing and having those readers around, there seems to be a movement or an expectation within readers of happiness, of up, and of characters they have to love, and this sort of stuff. And because we're giving such a voice to a great number of readers, especially genre readers and the like, who have a certain expectation. They're buying a product.
Right.
They want a certain result. If they don't get that result, they get really cross.
Right.
And it is, there's more and more pressure, I assume, because the market it seems to be getting sort of squashed into that, especially with how much marketing is going on, to write to those kinds of strictures, you know, to keep it in it, to do what you've done and go against it. It seems to be, it's paid off for you, but it seems to be a risky move in this environment.
I think it's difficult, or it's different when you are, let's say, I mean, I hate to use this term, a genre writer, and your work has been marketed by the publishing house as entertainment, whether you're an author or a filmmaker or director or what have you, because then yes, there is a certain sort of commercial expectation, and you are really answering an audience's needs or desires. With this book, I mean, there's a couple things. When you are not expected to make any money from the book, when no one has any expectations, and you don't need the book to make money, it gives you a great sense of freedom. It really allows you to do what you want. And any sort of creative person needs to be able to do that. And if you don't do that, that's fine. But you do make a choice. You make a choice between hedging your bets about popularity and reception, and writing what you want to write. And sometimes those two things don't align.
Mm. Well, I mean, you're shortlisted for the Booker. You were robbed and you didn't get it.
Thank you.
But what you have got is a bigger prize altogether, is a book that will be on the shelves in bookshops for years and years to come, which is the holy grail, pretty much, of writing, is to get that book that is considered by booksellers to be an essential part of their bookshop.
Well, I hope so.
It already is. That's the thing. That's how it's already. Because of that, the number of people that I hear that are outside of my industry, you sort of get a bit foggy when you're writing a little bit.
Yes, that's true.
That are outside the industry who are coming to it, and it seems so late. I'm like, what are you doing? But they're coming to it, and they're coming to it through their own the grapevines they're on the end of, and they're hearing about it organically without any help from any marketers like me. That, for me as a bookseller, is really exciting, because it's one of those indicators that the book is here to stay.
Well, that's really kind of you to say, and I if that's the case, I'm honored, because I think that book publishers, and again, I say this as someone who was in the industry, tend to forget that readers have a difficult time surfacing books, and they tend to speak to the same kind of 4,000 or 5,000 people, this is in the U.S., who know how to find books and sort of know how, who are part of the bookosphere, let's say, and who know how to find what they want to read. And so to have a book reach beyond that, you know, obviously crucial and necessary and important audience, to an audience of people who may not be readers regularly, or who have found this book because someone that they like has recommended it, has been not only thrilling, but has said something interesting to me about how, you know, the book buying public has changed, and how the marketing of books has changed even in the last 4 or 5 years. It's just become, I think, much more, it's impossible for a publisher to guess how a book finds its audience, in a sense. Mm. And so this has happened in a very sort of old school and grassroots way. Just the, you know, accretion of one book being recommended to another person and then that person passing it on. And that's, there is nothing more, I think, deeply satisfying or honoring for a writer than that.
I have a question about the size, because I'm a lover of big books.
Yeah, me too.
And looking out, when you have your story to tell, and you could feasibly write a shorter book, you could feasibly put this in and write a Raymond Carver short story and try and capture and leave everything else up to the imagination. But to indulge into putting it all in, I mean, I get excited just by the idea of having that canvas to fill. That, in my mind, with literary titles, it generally seems to be something that people did in the past. Mm. You know, you've got your big Thomas Manns, and you're in the 19th century, it seemed to be if you weren't big, you weren't anywhere.
Mm.
Taking the time to really examine this in this light, for an artist, I know, I've spoken to some who do lots of little ones, and I've been asking them for a big fatty. Is it something that you prepare for? Is it something that is just innate in you that this story actually demanded it of you? How did you approach such a massive canvas?
Well, I knew it was going to be a long book almost from the start, and I sort of about 50 pages into it, I knew just kind of from the pace that I wanted to keep, and the sort of languor with which I wanted the book to unfold, that it was going to, I predicted it would be about 1,100 manuscript pages, and it ended up being 960, and that translates to, you know, 720-odd book pages. So I was pretty close. And, you know, I think that you can tell a whole life, and a very big life, in a very short amount of space. I always talk about Mona Simpson's Off Keck Road, which is a novella, fewer than I think 180 pages, about an entire woman's life lived in Wisconsin. Or I think about one of my favorite contemporary books by Peter Rock called My Abandonment, which is again a very brief book and a very richly detailed life. But I wanted readers to really feel they could relax into this universe, and that it would be someplace that they would be inhabiting for some time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just knew that I wanted to take my time with this, that there was no reason to rush it, that it was going to be about the accumulation of details, that there was going to be a sense of history being made and being referred back to and looped back upon. You know, I knew that I would want to put in little details in the first section that would be alluded to again in the sixth or seventh. So it was a very structural book. I mean, the structure came alongside the themes and the characters, and those are the three things that really, you know, made this book happen in a sense. And I had a very clear idea of the structure I wanted to lay out, and then within that structure, the sort of pace I wanted to keep. And I do think that, you know, I do think one of my skills as a writer is structure and paciness. And I think that I wanted to sort of keep it at, you know, to smooth even pace throughout.
Hmm.
All I want to talk about is the book because it's so fresh in my mind. The thing that killed me the most is that up until, and I won't, I'm going to try and not mention actual plot points for people who haven't read it, but towards the end part, when an incident happens, that after that you kind of, you know that it's
right
bad from there.
Right.
Up until that point, there had been a gradual building of hope in face of such despair and suffering. And so many what ifs threaded throughout, like what if Jude had had Harold and Julie as his parents, and what if he had spoken to Anna, or what if all these things had happened, it could have turned out differently.
Right.
And what if he'd gone to therapy? Like, do you really think it was inevitable, and that it is inevitable for some people that they can't be healed ever?
Yes.
And that it's such a short answer, and I knew you were going to say it, but I can't take it.
I do think it is, and I think that we're very intolerant of people who for whom that is the answer. And mm-hmm. I think that often when we mean to be helpful by saying to people that if you try harder, if you work harder, if you hope harder, then life will turn around for you. And I don't think that's the case for everyone. And there it becomes an oppressive act to be alive and to be hopeful.
Mm. Yeah, no, I'm with you. I've known friends who have found themselves in situations, and the thing that drives them to the greatest despair is the continual reminder of this. Some things are just there. That's it.
You
don't talk to someone with an amputation that one day will grow back.
Right. That's right. That's right.
But people will talk to people with depression as if it's all going to be cheery later on.
Yeah, that's right. That's a very good way of, that's a very good analogy. Yeah. Mm.
But then there's the beauty and the courage of the people who, because in many ways he fought, right? I don't know how to say this without, again, a character in your book.
Yeah.
fought against such impossible odds for so long. And like, the overwhelming question or feeling or just pondering really that I have as I finish the book is like, what makes us live and what is our lives? Like what's the point really? Not in a despairing way, but like, what are we here for?
And one of the things that I really thought about a great deal while writing this book is this question of, can one person save another? And I think the answer is no, but the beauty of love is that you keep doing it anyway. It is something that you do without hope of a result. And obviously we live in a results-oriented culture. And so to have something that you invest so much time and energy in, in loving someone, and to do it even though you know that it may not result in consequences that you like, or that it may not be able to heal them, or it may not be able to save them, is I think the beauty of being alive, that you do it despite knowing that it won't necessarily change anything.
Yeah.
That's actually, we just put that on the back of the book. That's divine. Yeah.
And just questioning, what makes, just the title really, what makes a life little or small or good or bad? And I remember two points actually that made me think this when I was reading. One was, I can't actually remember who said it, but I can't remember it was like Jude wanted reassurance that his life, as sad and dark as it had been, was still a life.
Right.
And that later there was another moment with Willem where they're all questioning what the point of their life is, and if you don't have kids, does that mean that you haven't fulfilled some purpose? And Willem responds that he thinks that his life was to do with making his friends happy.
Right.
And it's such a simple idea, and it's a small thing. I'm getting emotional again. Yeah. Look what you've done to me. It's such a small thing, but it's so profound.
Thank you. And I wish I could say that I remember these lessons on a daily basis. I really don't. So much of the book for me, the process of writing it was, questioning, working through my own questions about what it means to be a friend and what it means to love somebody, what it means to be a good person in the world. And which isn't to say that I practice all of these things often or even sometimes, but I do believe in them.
And I just keep pelting you with questions.
No, it's fine.
Another thing that I wondered about, because the relationships in this book are so sort of complicated and bound up, in romance and romantic love and stuff. And it was only when I finished that I sort of realized that there are very few female characters in the book, and it was not something I noticed at all as I was reading.
Mm.
And afterwards, I just wondered, is it a story that can... Do you feel it just can only be told with men and male friendship?
I do. I mean, so much of this book is about the characters literally not having the language to say certain things because they haven't been taught to express them. And certainly men are not encouraged to express certain emotions, which is not to say they don't have them. It's simply that I don't know very many men whose parents told them it's okay to say that you're ashamed or you're embarrassed or you're scared or you're vulnerable. It's simply not what we teach males to discuss.
Mm.
And whereas women, for better and for worse, are allowed to discuss all of those things. Someone once asked me if this book could have been written with female characters, and I said yes, but it probably would have been a third of the length. I just think that it would have been, women are allowed to discuss these things. And I always think it's a great gift as a novelist to be able to work with a group of people who have limitations imposed upon them by law or by society about what they can and cannot do and what a human does to compensate around those rules.
I'm an absolute sucker for any depiction of men showing emotion or coming to sort of some sort of resolution together. Because having been brought up a man to have all those and have been told not to do this, not to do that, it just gets me. Yeah,
right.
It's one of those.
Right.
So made being exposed at such length to it and being made to look into it and look at my relations with my brothers and other male friends. I'm far more likely to flock to women because it's easier to express it in that direction than the other.
Right.
Unfortunately, we're going to have to wrap it up. I feel that we could, because it's a little life and it's a big, big fat book, this is a little podcast, but it could be a really big podcast.
I could keep going forever. I'm so full of feelings and emotion and questions.
I just want to let our listeners know that we highly recommend the book. We're so happy to have had you here to
talk
to us about it. And we would have liked to have gone on for much longer, but our restrictions on time and life. But A Little Life is available through booktopia.com.au. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Sarah and John. Thank you for everything.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.